Okay, good evening, everybody. This is session two of Buddhism in a Nutshell. And how many people were not here last week? Wow, I did chase people off. This is a new group. Okay. Okay, how many people have, out of that group, how many people is this their first time at Kadampa Center? Well, welcome. Okay, there's a couple of newcomer booklets and information out there afterwards we can help you with if you'd like. How many people out of that first group, this is your first visit to a Buddhist center? Well, welcome, really. And congratulations for really stepping beyond your comfort zone, probably. It's a fun group, so you're fine. Okay. That's all right. All right. Here's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to do a brief review. So those of you that missed last week, you are fine. Okay? People really can come into this class anytime. It's really probably a little bit difficult maybe to come to the last class without the base, but the first couple of classes, because we do so much review on truly the basics that you're not going to be anywhere that you're not going to be able to catch up to real quick. Okay? We're going to do a brief review. We're going to go through a little bit of that history of Buddhism. We're going to go through a little bit more discussion, more detail on the role of the mind in Tibetan Buddhism. And we're going to go into more detailed discussion about the Four Noble Truths tonight. Okay, so that kind of gives you the overview for tonight. But the first thing that we're going to do, if the streaming isn't working, Chris, I'm okay with that. They don't need to see me. It's all right. We're all right. Okay, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to go straight into a brief meditation. Okay, every class that we have now, we're going to start with a brief meditation. We're going to end with a brief meditation because that helps us to set our tone for the class. It kind of helps us to get our minds here. I don't know about you guys, but I had a crazy busy day. And it always just takes a few minutes to just settle in, become a little bit more present. So this is a way for us to just settle in, let go of all of the stresses of the day, and just be very present and allow yourselves to be present and just let go of everything else. You know, for the next hour and a half, this is what we're doing, and we've chosen to do it. So let's just give ourselves that time to do it and that permission. So, if you remember, again, from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and especially here at Kadampa Center in our tradition, we start with a 7-point meditation posture. This is the number one handout that was on the website. And we're going to go through this every time. And then once you start to learn it, it will start to feel a little bit more natural. So I'm going to continue to kind of read from this so that we can get this base. And then the more we do it, the more natural it will become. All right, and then we're going to do, I think, the scanning the body. My plan is that we'll start the class with the meditation that we ended with last time. That way you'll get to try each of them twice. And if you remember, we talked about the different kinds of meditation, concentration meditation and analytical meditation. The concentration is kind of the workout and the training that will allow us to learn how to use our minds better so that we can do more thoughtful meditation and more work with our minds. Okay, the plan for me, my goal would be to have us do quite a few of the concentration meditations, and then maybe the last class we introduce an analytical meditation so you can really see the difference. And then how this works from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. Okay, so that's the goal. For those of you that have been meditating for a long time and do different traditions, I challenge you to set those aside for this 5 weeks and try this, because there's many different types. Okay, and you're here to try something new. So just try these, see if they work. Some things will work for you, some things may not, but give it a shot and give it an honest opinion, because I think us as Americans, we tend to come in, oh, I like it, that works great, I don't like it, it's done. Give it a couple, three times before you make that decision to throw it out. All right? So again, this is concentration meditation from a Buddhist perspective. We get in our 7-point meditation posture, starting with the legs. If you're sitting on the cushions, Sit with your legs crossed. If you can go into the Vajra position, that's phenomenal. This gentleman does a phenomenal job right there. And I could do that when I was 17. There's nothing holy about sitting on the cushion. You can meditate just as well sitting on the chair. The reason that we have this, went through it again, we're going to review this. The reason that we go through these positions, the reasons that we do this, is so it gives us a very stable position to hold for a long period of time so that we can let go of thinking about our bodies. All right? So it's not because of ritual. It's not because of something spiritual. It is literally a very conventional base to sit so that we can hold this position for a long time. There's a reason that they've been doing it this way for 2,500 years. Okay, so we start with our legs. Legs crossed in the Vajra, the full lotus position. You can sit just cross-legged. You can sit in a chair. Again, if your feet don't reach the floor easily, get a cushion to put underneath your feet. You want to sit forward in the chair a little bit. All right, so legs very stable. Arms, your arms will be held loosely in your lap. In our tradition, we take our right hand, we put it on our left, we touch our thumbs together, and we tuck it just under our navel. Okay, and that allows us to keep the words akimbo, which is always such an odd word to say, but it gets your arms out a little bit from your body, and that allows the airflow. Okay, so that allows the air to flow. You just relax a little bit. Your back is probably one of the most important parts. It should be held straight, but not totally rigid. Don't get real stiff, but just go straight like your vertebrae is just stacked. All right? This helps your energy to flow, and you bring your shoulders back a little bit. Okay, and again, that's kind of that regal position. That opens your lungs up to breathe. All right? The eyes, in the beginning, it's probably easiest to keep them closed. But if you keep them closed, you need to be careful that you don't get too drowsy. If you keep them wide open, you're going to be distracted. So work on maybe just a slight opening and unfocused in front of you in that three or four feet in front of you, just down so that you're not quite distracted. If you need to close them, that's okay. We're just trying to open our minds and let it be a little bit easier. Your jaw and your mouth relaxed. Teeth slightly apart, not clenched, your lips lightly touching. Your tongue should rest lightly on the roof of your mouth, on the upper palate, slightly like just behind the front teeth. Why? To help with the saliva. All right. Your head should be slightly inclined forward. Again, it helps for your gaze. If you're up too high, your chin's too high, you're too distracted out here. If it's too low, you can fall asleep. So there's all these things, and again, one of those little tricks that I used in the past is pretend that there's a string at the top of the crown of your head pulling, and that just pulls your neck, it pulls your back up, it helps you just to sit up just a little bit. Okay. We're going to do the scanning the body. Focus your attention on your breathing and just breathe naturally. Become present in the moment and place where you are. Just focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present and ready to engage in meditation. And we're going to set our motivation. We'd like to create an altruistic motivation for this meditation session. Think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. So just think that way for just a minute. Focus your attention on your physical body. Find that most suitable sitting position with your spine straight and erect, a position in which you can be aware and awake but not stiff or rigid. Focus your attention on the lowermost point of your body, where your body is in contact with the earth. Feel the substance and earthy character of your body. Concentrate for a moment on that contact, on the weight and substance of this physical form. Pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while focusing here. Slowly and mindfully move your attention upward through your body. Pay close attention to every aspect of your body and your physical sensations. Note areas of tension and relax them. Note sensations of coolness or warmth. Note places where one part of your body is touching another. Slowly move upward through your legs and your hips, your hands and your lap. Note the curves of your body silhouette. Move upward your belly, your waist, the curves of your arms. Continue to move upward. The rising and falling of your chest with your breathing, the curves of your shoulders. Keep moving upward. Slowly, mindfully, pay special attention to your shoulders and neck and jaw. If there's tension there, relax those areas. Move still upward. The tilt of your head until you reach the crown of your head. Allow your attention to rest at your crown for just a moment. Pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while focusing here. Is your mind's character different while concentrating here than when you were focusing on the lowermost point of your body? What differences can you note? Now slowly move your attention back downward through your body in the same way. Move slowly, mindfully, noting everything about your body as you move your attention back down. Bring your attention all the way back down to the cushion or the floor, the chair, wherever your body is in contact with the earth. And again, focus your concentration at this point and note the character of your consciousness when focusing here. And again, note the nature of your mind state when concentrating here and note any differences from your mind state when you were concentrating at your crown. Okay, finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. And bring your attention back to the room. That always helps me. Just get back here. Did any questions come up from the last class? Did you think of anything afterwards that you wish, God, I wish I'd asked her that? Maybe by session 4 you'll all be going, yeah. Okay, we're going to do a brief review, especially since we do have so many. And this actually is what Buddhism is all about. We're going to be going over and over and over the same information, actually, this entire class. It's just going to come at you from different ways with different perspectives, but it's basically the same thing. Because the funny thing is you think you know it, right, about the time you think you have it, then you hear it a different way, and you have those little aha moments, and that happens all the time, and that's really what this is all about. So again, a little bit of review. How many people weren't here last week? Boy, I should do a count. So we did. We lost some people. Was I that scary? I know. That's a good way to put it. All right. Again, this is Buddhism 101. So this is just basics, Buddhism in a nutshell. We're going to be skipping across the top of a lot of the basic concepts. We are not doing any deep diving here. All right. I think the last class that we had several practitioners, and in this class we actually have a lot of practitioners that are Kanapa Center members. Actually, Kanapa Center members that have been here for a long time, raise your hands, please. And you could put your hand way up there. So we have a lot of people here that can help answer questions. It would be nice toward the end of class. I always try to open this up for discussion and get people talking. And it's very helpful to hear things from other perspectives. And we have a lot of long, long time practitioners here that will have some very great perspectives. But I am going to challenge us to stay at the top. Okay, that's the purpose of this class. It's very easy to get way off tangent and start deep diving a little bit. We have other classes for those, and this is kind of a prep class and kind of a little teaser class for some of the phenomenal classes where you will have the time to really get into things. Like here, we're going to have 20 minutes, session 4, to cover karma. Okay, we have a whole 5-week session of an hour and a half each night where we can go in depth with those things with a lot more advanced leaders and teachers than I am. All right, so we're going to skip along the top, and I'm going to try to keep us there. All right? Okay, the Buddha. Who was the Buddha? 2,600 years ago, the child was born to a king and queen in India, and they wanted to protect him because at the time he was born, they had a seer come in and do a reading, and this wise man, again, I don't think we have anything kind of like this, but they did a reading, and he said he's either going to be a great king or a great spiritual leader. Well, the king, of course, wanted him to follow in his footsteps. We all do that. Oh, I'm a doctor. I want my child to be a doctor. You know, that we all do that. Nothing different here. But he started to raise his son in this incredibly protective environment. I'm really going to make this a fast talk, so I'm missing a lot of things. He wanted to keep his child safe. He wanted to keep his child from seeing any of the negative and the awful things that are in everyday life. So he created this wonderful, safe cocoon of an environment where this young prince, Siddhartha Gautama, did not see death. He did not see sickness. He did not see people in pain. He did not see any suffering. And he was raised like this. He was a phenomenally bright child and young man, and he excelled in all of the different athletics that they had, all of the different arts, and he grew up in this wonderful castle where he just never saw anything ugly. You know, he never saw any of the suffering. I wish, you know, I've tried to do that with my children. I wish I could always do that with my children. All right. Then there came a time where the prince just decided, I need to see a little bit more. I want to understand what's going on. I want to see more. And he snuck out. I had three boys. They each did that. Snuck out one night with a couple of his friends and servants, and they went out and explored the town and the countryside. And during that time, he saw four sights. They call it the four sights. Okay. He saw a sick person, an old person, a dead body, and a wandering mendicant, a wandering monk. And those sights were shocking to him. He'd never seen them. And from that moment on, he changed. And he wanted to know more. He wanted to understand why. Why do people die? Why do people get sick? Why is that monk who is living out here with all this happening seem to have this calmness and this happiness? What has he got? What is death? We all ask these questions, and he did too. But he decided to leave everything and go look and try to find these answers. And the first place he went, okay, again, we're talking 2,500, 2,600 years ago in India. They had many seekers, spiritual seekers. And he fell in with the group that was doing that, and they were practicing that very harsh asceticism, where they were just going to turn away, and they subsisted on, you know, just a few grains of rice a day, and literally just tried to work on their minds that way and tried to learn these things. And he did that for about 6 years. Don't hold me to any of these harsh dates. Read the book, okay? But he did that for probably about 6 years. And he became so weak that he discovered that he was so weak that he couldn't meditate, that he couldn't study, that he couldn't learn, because it was so hard, that it was so distracting for him, that he, the story goes that he was laying by a river and just basically almost giving up because he was too weak to go on. And a musician came down on a canoe, a raft, and the musician was stringing his instrument. It was kind of like a guitar, a lute type of thing, whatever the name of that musical instrument was. And the musician was saying, well, you can't string it too tight and you can't have it too loose. The perfection of music is having it done just right. The middle way is what came out of that. And that was what kind of triggered his, we can't take it too far one way or the other. You go down the middle way. And then a young woman came along, and she fed him and brought him back to strength. And then he decided, I need to figure this out the middle way. At that point, it all kind of started to come together. And he went, and he sat under the Bodhi tree, and he looked at his mind. And that's what he did. All he focused on was his mind. Nothing out here, his mind. And that's basically all Buddhism is. It is about your mind. And he looked at his mind. And all of those things, at the very end, it said that the Maras and the distractions come. Have any of you tried to do anything really hard, and then you have those little voices of doubt that come in, oh, you can't do that? And those little things that talk to you and say you can't do it, that those distractions that come at you that kind of try to take your will away, okay, those things came to him and said, well, you can't become enlightened. You can't figure this out. You know, who are you to do this? And they say at that moment that he became enlightened, that he reached out, it's in figures of these tankas, he reached out, called the earth to witness that I can do this. I can look at my mind. I can become enlightened. I can know this. And he called the earth to witness, and he became enlightened. All right? He was just a man who became enlightened. He was not a god. So what does that mean? When he became enlightened, he couldn't just stand up and wish that we all became enlightened. Okay? Because he's not a god. He didn't have that power. But he had the knowledge, and therefore he began to teach. Because that's what he could do. He could share how he became enlightened. And so that's when he became the Buddha and began to teach. His first lesson, going back, okay, he went back to those monks. Remember those that group of monks that he was with that were practicing the asceticism? He went back with them. And their first look at him, first they were, you know, upset with him because he left and went on his own. But then after they look and you do that, you kind of look at somebody and, you know, he's got something there. And they realized, he's got something there. So they started to follow him and listen to him. And the first major teaching that he did was on the fourth noble truth at Sarnath. Okay? So the four sites, Bodhgaya is where he sat under the Bodhi tree. The Buddha means enlightened one. That's where that name comes from. That's the meaning. Buddha means enlightened one. His name, Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakya means clan. Muni means sage, wise one. Buddha, enlightened one. So that's how that name came to be. I promise I'll fix, we just got the whole PowerPoint thing. I'll get there. Okay, so what is enlightenment? We're talking about these things. What actually is enlightenment? Full awakening. It means we're removing all of the obscurations, all negativities, and fully developing all virtuous states of mind, positive. The Buddha is saying that we can do this. We can take and develop our minds into all positive states of mind, and we can remove the negative states of mind. That's what the practice is. And the Buddha is saying it's doable. He became a teacher, and for the next 40 years he taught. All right. several major teachings. You'll hear, I'm going to talk about some of these major terms that you're going to hear. Turning up the wheel of Dharma. Those are kind of those major teachings. Okay, we're only going to cover one of them in this class, the Four Noble Truths. But there are others that you can look at. They say that there's over 84,000 historical teachings of the Buddha. That's what these are up on our altar. All right, if you pulled those down and opened them up, they would be long rectangular pieces of paper with the teachings on them. Now, these are in Tibetan, right? I believe. Are they Sanskrit? Tibetan. Because Geshe Sangpo reads them. I've seen them. So I'm pretty sure that they're Tibetan. Now, literally, the Buddha, this has been translated in from Pali to Sanskrit to Tibetan to English to German to, so we're always working with different meanings of words. So one of the things that we're going to be doing in this class is being very clear about what we're talking about. So we're going to have a lot of definitions going on here. Okay, Dharma. The Dharma, we hear this word a lot. What does that mean? The Dharma means that which protects, that which holds you and protects you. From a conventional sense, it's the teachings and the actions, those positive actions. The teachings, these are the Dharma. The ultimate meaning of Dharma are those realizations that are attained through learning these teachings, through working with this. So it's those realizations, those aha moments when you get it. Not just the book learning, but all of a sudden you have that experiential, oh, I get it. That's the ultimate meaning of the Dharma. And Buddhism, totally, completely, 100% is about your mind. All of these colors, all of these pictures, all of these symbols, all of this stuff, it is about nothing but your mind. Buddhism is about the mind. Specifically, it's about your mind. And we're going to get through that a little bit more as we go. So all of these are tools to help us with our mind. Come on in. Okay, so it's spread. Buddhism spread. It spread through India, Sri Lanka, Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Tibet. There are many different Buddhist traditions, and it was really because of the geographic and socio variations, the ethnological changes, but the basics are all the same. Okay, it spread all over the world, and things just kind of changed, and it changed a little bit in Japan because of the culture there. It changed a little bit in Tibet because of the culture there. But those are mostly cultural type things. The basics of Buddhism are the same. So whatever flavor of Buddhism that you're reading about, the core teachings are there. Okay, we have two main strains, Hinayana and Mahayana. Again, they're very, very similar. Hinayana is more called the individual release from suffering, nirvana, reaching nirvana, personal release from suffering. The Mahayana is called the universal, and that's you not only reach nirvana, but you reach enlightenment. And we're going to talk about the differences there a little bit later. But again, the basics, it's just like learning to swim. You can't save somebody else unless you know how to swim. So one is not better than the other. We really study both. You need to have both. One is not better than the other. They're very similar, but there's some slight differences that just add a little bit more. I'm kind of flipping around the board here, but we're doing a review. Okay, in Tibetan Buddhism, there are four schools, four denominations. They're all found in the West. Shakya, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Gelupa. Okay, we're a Gelupa tradition. The Kadapa Center is in the Gelupa tradition. We follow the tradition of the Dalai Lama. And why is that important? From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and actually from any perspective, when you go to college, if you go to a school, you want to know who the teachers are. You want to know what you're going to learn. You want to know exactly how good they are or where they're at. You're trying to get a degree. You're trying to get something. You're going to research the teachers. Same thing in this tradition. Coming to a Gelupa school, I chose this because I knew that this was going to be in the tradition of the Dalai Lama, who is somebody that I have loved and respect my whole life. So I was looking for that. So I knew that this wasn't going to be a New Age thing or something. Not that that's wrong. It's just not what I was looking for. Okay, so this is a very specific tradition. And that's what we're studying here, the Dalai Lama. Is there anybody that doesn't know who the Dalai Lama is? Just to make sure. Okay. I just want to make sure. So the Dalai Lama is pictured right there. He has been the political leader, but he's now the spiritual leader. He's like, we're not even going to go to that subject at all, of what's going on with China and Tibet. We can have conversations about that elsewhere. But he's the spiritual leader of all of the schools, okay? Not just the Galupa, even though that's his tradition. And Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the two monks that are side by side in front of the Dalai Lama there, they created the FPMT, Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, FPMT for short. These are monks that way back in the day, in the 50s, when all of the hippies were going over to Tibet, all those movies came out and everybody wanted to, you know, become enlightened, both medically and, you know, spiritually. They decided, you know what, if all of these Westerners are coming over here, we should go to them. We need to go to them. So they came over to the United States and they started traveling. And they started teaching over here. And slowly it just started to grow. And they, all of a sudden, we've got 170, 180 centers worldwide that are part of the FPMT. Now, we don't get support from them. In fact, it goes the other way. We're helping them. But they help us to get the teachers. They help to go to the different monasteries where the Kopan or Sarah J, and they help to bring the teachers to us. We're very fortunate that we have two Geshes. We have two Tibetan monks from India here. Okay, Geshe Gelug Choda and Geshe Tsongpo. Geshe Paulden Tsongpo. Geshe Gelug, how many people have come on Sundays and seen Geshe-la? Okay, so some of you that haven't, he's traveling right now. He won't be back until December because he'll be doing travels and teaching. I'm telling you, come back. Come to a Sunday teaching and listen to Geshe-la, because that's one of the main reasons that we're coming to Kadampa Center. We are so fortunate to have a teacher of his qualities and his knowledge. Geshe is a title. It means that he has studied for many, many years in the monastery, and he is a very phenomenally well-read, well-known, very advanced teacher of Buddhism. So Geshe is the title, just like doctor, and not only is our Geshe Gelug a Geshe, he's a Larampa Geshe, which is kind of like summa cum laude, and he's the most humble person you would ever want to meet, but he is so far advanced, it's amazing. I'll spend any time that I can with him. So I really invite you all to come back when he's back in town. So Geshe Gelug Choda is our teacher. He's been here for 14 years. Geshe Paulden Tsongpo is his assistant. We also have three Western nuns here with us. And Venerable Kondo is one of ours. And that's amazingly fortunate. There are centers in the world that don't have any Sangha. That's our spiritual community, Sangha. Not only do we have two Tibetan monks, the real deal, I call them, we also have three Western nuns. Why does that work? Because when we come up to some kind of a cultural difference, I remember sitting in class one time, and we were trying to explain to Geshe-la the problems we were having with our kids and their Nintendo games. And he totally didn't understand what we were talking about with the computer games because he never had seen that. So one of the Western nuns tried to explain it to him, and it became a whole teaching on computer games. But it does help sometimes. And it helps because it's one of the reasons that we're here for our spiritual studies. You're listening to me when you could be listening to them. All right? So I'm a good intro there. Kadampa Center, we are named the Kadampa Center. Kadampa means those who put the teachings of the Buddha into practice. So it's a very special name. Now, we have to be a little careful with that name because there's another group that calls themselves Kadampa, the new Kadampa tradition. That's a completely separate group that doesn't follow the Dalai Lama. They have different teachings. So when you're doing your searches, because I've had that come up a couple of times, just make sure that you're over here with Kadampa Center in the Dalai Lama so that the information that you're getting is the same information that we're sharing here. But that's a very special name, those who actually take the practice, the teachings, into our everyday practice. So Buddhism is about the mind. Everything is about your mind. Developing the positive states that lead to happiness, removing the negative states that cause suffering. What happens when you've done this? You're enlightened. Seriously, that's it. It sounds so easy, doesn't it? It should be. But to try to actually practice it, to try to actually do it, that's the practice. It really simply is that simple to say. That's it. But when we start talking about how hard it is to actually do it, that's when the fun is going to start. Okay? So what are we talking about when we're talking about our mind, just so we're all on the same page? From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, the mind is not the brain. The brain is the physical part. Okay, the mind, from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, is, we can use the word consciousness, same thing. It's non-physical. It's clear. So it's kind of like the clear sky or a clear lake. A mirror is a good thing. Nice analogy for it. And then the thoughts going through our mind, okay, those are like the clouds. The thoughts going through are like the reflections on the mirror. Does that make sense? Try to start thinking about that. We actually are going to do some meditations that are going to help bring that a little bit more to life. What else is the mind? It is aware. We talk about our senses. Sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, the five senses. Tibetan Buddhists have a sixth sense, mental awareness. Mental awareness is the sixth sense. The mind is aware. Its function is to know. And it has no beginning and no end. It is a continuous stream that is always changing. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, because that's going to bring us into the next class, I think, where we'll start talking about rebirth. Okay? So this is the job of the mind. This is the mind. And everything you see in this room and everything that we're going to talk about is about the mind. We're relating everything to the mind. All right, the Lam Rim, this is another just a word I want you to start to be comfortable with. The Lam Rim is actually the organization of all the Buddha's teachings by Lama Atisha. It is the original Buddhism for Dummies book. Okay? So all of these teachings, all of these things, for us to try to understand that in one lifetime is almost impossible. So way back, I'm not even sure how many hundreds of years ago, there was a monk that came from India and went to Tibet, and he really looked at everything, and he rewrote a commentary on this, and it's called the Lam Rim. Actually, Lama Tsongkhapa did it, and Lama Atisha did it later. I'm mucking this up. Atisha first, and then Lama Tsongkhapa. Okay, thank you. This is why you're here. There you go. Atisha. Right.
And Lama Tsongkhapa did a very long, extensive commentary on it, which we study as the Lama Chenmo.
There you go. Okay. So what she said. And why is that important? Because these are the books that we're studying. This is the commentaries that we're studying. We really don't study the teaching so much as we study the commentaries. All right? Because it helps us to put things a little bit more into perspective. But I just want you to become a little bit familiar with the name Lam Rim, because you're going to hear it here at the center a lot. We actually have a class on Wednesday nights that's only about the Lam Rim, where we're going through it page by page by page. And it's really taking the whole Buddhist path into a graduated path. Because it's, if you do A and you do B and you get to C, it is that path. And we're going to talk about that a little bit here. But that's the path to get rid of the negativities and bring up the positive. There's an actual roadmap to do this. Step-by-step instructions. All right, let's go over here. How much time do I have? I always have to watch this. Okay, the Four Noble Truths. How many have heard of this? The First Noble Truth. Okay, we're going to go to one word right now, suffering. Again, I talked about the fact that words mean different things. Okay, when we as Americans, we think of suffering, what do you think of? What do you think of when I say suffering? mental illnesses, pain,
loss,
things like that. Okay, so we have all of these kind of things that we put on the words suffering, but the Buddhists have kind of, it means so much more. It means so much more. So I want to use the word dukkha, okay? Because what I want to kind of do, dukkha, we're going to use the word dukkha instead of suffering. Why? Because I want you to open up the concept mind here. Okay? Dukkha instead of suffering. We'll talk about a little bit more deeply why. Because when we talk about suffering, we think about pain. We think about these things. So let's break down the types of suffering that we've got. Okay? So this is, we're going to go here. Okay, suffering of pain. Pain, that's kind of what we talked about. Second type, we're defining suffering. Suffering of change. Okay, and pervasive suffering. Everybody seems so quiet tonight. I don't know why that is. No train. That is one. That's true. We haven't had a train all night. Yeah, that's very true. Okay. Suffering of pain. This is just the suffering that when we think of suffering, when Americans think of suffering, that's number one. That's what we think of. Sickness. Death. Hurt, you know, you break your leg, you break your arm. That's kind of what we think of pain. Sure, mental illness, things like that. That's what we think of as pain. That's what Americans normally think of as suffering. It's just that one. Suffering of change. We suffer in ways that we don't even understand. And part of what we're going to talk about is defining the suffering so you can actually see it. Suffering of change. I wanted that new car so bad I could taste it. I got my new car and I love it. And all of a sudden, boom, that new car just got hit, scratched, bent up. I'm not so happy with my new car. We think that we have this permanent happiness that came with that car. I just got a new job. I just got my job. I'm so happy with it. You have it for about a year, and then you have your boss changes, and boom, things change. You don't like this boss. You don't like your job anymore, right? I love chocolate cake, okay? And chocolate cake makes me happy. The first two pieces of chocolate cake make me happy. By about the third piece of chocolate cake, I'm not so happy with chocolate cake anymore. By the fourth piece of chocolate cake, I'm really not liking chocolate cake anymore. Or I like chocolate cake, but some people are allergic to it, so they can't have it at all. But it's change, that suffering of change. You think you like it. You're so, today is a good day to explain it. Okay, we go outside. I love this warmth. I love this warmth. I lived in Minnesota for 6 years. I love North Carolina. Okay, I was outside for a while, and I got too hot, and I needed to go back into the air conditioning. So all of a sudden, the heat, it was too much. And I didn't like the heat so much anymore. So I'm back into the air conditioning. My first thought, the air conditioning, oh, that feels so good. I love it. I'm going to make it even colder. I feel so much better. And about 20 minutes later, boy, I'm getting cold. I'm cold now. So it's this constant change. Does this make sense? This constant, the same thing that made you happy 15 minutes ago has changed, and now you're not so happy with that very thing. Does this make sense? Yes? Okay, so that's suffering of change. That's a big one. It happens to us all the time, and we just don't really see it. Okay, pervasive suffering. We're not going to spend too long on this. This is a harder concept. This is the easy ways to explain it. This is, we are going to be suffering just because of the very lives that we have. Because we are human, we're set up to die. There isn't a single person in this room that's not going to die. Okay? So it's this pervasive suffering because of the very nature of our lives. Okay? I love my husband. The very nature of the fact that we're humans means that he's gonna die. There's nothing I can do about it. This very pervasive kind of, there's something kind of off a little bit. This feeling that we have that we wished we knew more, that we understood the meaning of life, this constant, a little bit undertow of dissatisfaction. Okay, this is really hard to kind of go to this concept a little bit. The things that make you happy. This is like when the happy things happen, when the good things happen. That almost sets you up to have the negative coming. Yes. Mike, let's get the mic. This is here we go. This is what I'm saying. We've got some people.
Is this on? Can
yes.
you hear me?
Okay. Yep, it's directional.
Isn't change an inherent part of life? So wouldn't that be a part of this pervasive?
It is. It kind of brings a little bit together.
Okay.
Yeah. There isn't like a hard line many times in between. It's not so much dependent, but like I said, there's some things. Yeah, we're, because of this life that we live and the impermanence. So impermanence, there's another Buddhist word. We're going to talk about that in more detail. But so you see all of these things that we're talking about suffering here. This is why all of this, think about this as being dukkha. Because suffering, from our terminology, we just think of pain. But suffering is all of this. Now, if we could figure out how to make all of this go away, wouldn't that be awesome? That's what this is about. Now, when you're all learning about Buddhism, didn't y'all hear someplace along the line, oh, Buddhists are so depressing, all I talk about is suffering. Didn't you hear that one? I did. It's the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. Yeah, we talk about it because then we learn how to identify it so we can get rid of it. So it's the exact opposite. This is actually about the most joyful thing I've ever been doing. Those Buddhist monks I'm talking about, Geshe Thangpo, 5 minutes with them. You are just happy. I want what they want. It's that Harry Met Sally movie. I want some of that. Seriously, they're so joyful because they've figured so much of this out. Okay? So we talk about suffering so that we can identify it, because once you identify it, you can start working to get rid of it. It really is that easy. Now, I say it that easy, but now here's the practice. Okay, so we're sitting here and we're talking. Let's keep going because I'll get sidetracked. It'll come up again. All right. So the first one, we need to admit that we're sick. It's like going to the doctor. So if you can identify you are sick, this is admitting, here's the stuff going wrong. This is what's making me sick. Okay? We'll start identifying some of these things. And then you need to figure out what's causing it. Okay, so what's causing the suffering? What colors are you guys seeing best back there? Black? What are some negative states of mind? And just shout them. We don't need the mic. Anger. What's that?
Jealousy,
envy, good ones. I missed one. Jealousy. Somebody said something I missed. Envy. Yeah, same thing. Close. Yeah, it's good. Okay, let's talk about anger for a second. I used to think, I'm not an angry person. I'm one of the happiest people I know. I think I'm pretty good. Not too bad. I don't get mad too often. Then I learned that what are the stages of anger? Okay? Because anger, very seldom do you go, boom, right to anger, right? What are those stages? That first one, impatience. Okay? So if you put impatience down here, and all of a sudden realize that that's that first step. That's one of the first steps on that rung to anger. I can be impatient. So I started working with that. I started trying to be aware of the times that I'm impatient. I'm impatient when that red light comes up, man. In fact, when that yellow's there, I'm thinking, go. And then if I got to stop, there. I'm impatient with that light. I'm impatient when I go and I have to stand in line and wait. Okay, the DMV, I was just there the other day. Line, tweet. Okay, so those are those things that make me impatient. I've got many, but let's just use those for right now. So now all of a sudden I'm working, I'm practicing. I'm going to be this good little Buddhist. This is years ago. And I'm going to practice this. And I'm going to practice, okay, what is the antidote to impatience and anger? Okay, what is the antidote to anger? The antidote is patience. All right, so I'm going to start practicing patience. I'm going to start working on this, and I'm going to go, okay, when that red light comes up, that gives me the opportunity that I can take that little break for the next 2 minutes. I can say some of my prayers. I can say some of my mantras. I can do something. I can think wonderful things about my family and children. I'll take this as a positive moment and do something with it. This is a practice I've been doing for about 3 years now, and it's hilariously fun. I've got one now where I'm trying to get through the mantra before the light changes, because I've got a really long one. So now I'm actually changed. Oh, if it doesn't change yet, let me get through this. So it's these things, but try, you know, I challenge you to pick something that, whether it's standing in line or something like that, that does it, and try to find a little thing that would change your mind about this. But that's one of those things that I actually started working on to help me see the impatience that I had with different things. So I started simple. I started with red lights. Okay. Now they seriously, I promise you, do not bother me as much as they did 3-4 years ago. And it takes time. But it's just one of those little things that I was doing to recognize my own mind with impatience. I'm just giving you examples. Okay. I thought I'd done really well with this. I thought I've been practicing for a long time. I was just at a wedding a couple weeks ago, and I got pissed and got to see my mind. It's a process, okay? I'm not a Buddha yet. Y'all could be, and I'm not. This could all be about me right now. But that's one to work on. But then what are the antidotes? So we're going to have these things, but we have antidotes to these. Jealousy and envy. Okay, what would be the antidote to that? Love. There's a few. So all of a sudden, instead of seeing, you know, you just got that really cool car that I've been wanting so badly, I rejoice. I'm happy that you have that. And you try to work with that. You try to work with your mind. Instead of going down that route, the first thing is just to recognize it. It's just like 7-step program with AA. I am a drunk. Same thing. I am an impatient person. I am a jealous person. Just recognize it and then start to work with it and apply the opposite things. That's what we're doing here. Okay, so instead of being jealous, you know what? Rejoice that that person has that thing that you want. You know, and so try to say it without sarcasm. I'm really glad you got that. But to work with it, recognize it. This is about you. This is about your mind. So start to recognize your mind. Self-pity. Okay, now that's a tough one. We're going to be a little careful with that. And why? You cannot truly be compassionate with somebody else until you're compassionate with yourself first. So be very careful with labeling yourself with self-pity and things like that. Give yourself a break. Cut yourself some slack. You cannot be compassionate and loving with another person until you are with yourself. So be a little careful with that one. All right? Because cut yourself some slack. Learn to be compassionate with yourself. Just like the swimmer, you can't save another swimmer until you know how to swim. You can't truly show compassion until you can show it to yourself. Greed, easy one. Antidote for that. Generosity. Okay? That actually is one of the reasons, it's one of the practices that we have here is water bowls. That's the practice of generosity. From a Buddhist perspective, generosity is being able to give without regret. Okay, to be able to give without that, you know. Sure, you want it to pinch a little bit so that you know that you mean it. Okay, that you're really actually truly being generous. But you want to be able to give without regret. So we practice with water because that's something that we can freely give, and we imagine different things with that water. But it's a practice. Okay, it's a beautiful practice about giving and generosity. So greed, that's be generous. Wonderful antidote. Depression. Okay, that's again, that's another one of those. Cut yourself some slack here. But happiness, you know, depression, you know, you need to find out what that is and why that is. So that's actually may not be a negative that we're thinking that's icky like anger. We need to figure out what's going on there so we can help. Not so much stop it, help it. So just turn that thing. Fear can be a good thing. Fear doesn't necessarily be a negative. If there was a bear chasing me down the woods, I'd be afraid. And that's going to help me to run faster. So fear not necessarily is a, you know, but so define it. Break it down even further. You know, fear that you came here 2 times in the parking lot, a little afraid to come in. Okay, but then, wow, look at, here you are. So, but sometimes fear is not a bad thing. But a lot of times fear is the actual basis for a lot of anger. Because it's mostly fear of the unknown. Usually, what we're afraid of is something that we don't know. Usually. Okay, so it's just thinking about those. So what would the antidote to some of that would be? Knowledge. So some of that. Impatience, we've talked about, that's anger. Okay, hatred. Antidote to hatred. Love. Yeah, that one's... So let's go through from... There are 6 root afflictions, okay? So I just wanted you to understand this. Now let's talk about these 6 root afflictions. I'm going to get rid of this. So that and remember these words, because they're going to kind of come up again here with a few twists on it. And those of you guys that have been here for a while, anytime you want to chime in, go ahead. Okay, so 6 root afflictions. Oh, Tibetan Buddhists, we like lists. There's lists. There's 6 of these, there's 84 of those, there's 29 of these, there's 10 of these, 12 of these, 52 of those, and the lists will break down into other lists. So if you like lists, you like organization, this is for you. Okay. 6 root afflictions. So everything, afflictions. Everything's going to kind of come off of these. Okay, ignorance. Anger, attachment, this is a big word, attachment, we're going to get into that, pride, we didn't talk about that as a negative thought, doubt, and wrong view. Just about all of those negative things that we talked about just a few minutes ago fall in here, don't they? Okay, we didn't do pride. All right, what would be... First of all, what is pride? That's kind of holding ourselves up at the cost of somebody else, right? Not so much confidence, but superiority, so pride. So what is the antidote to pride? Humility. Okay, so most of you have seen people come in and they do prostrations. Prostrations are the practice of humility. All right, we're humbling ourselves to the teachings. We're not, I still remember that one too. I'm not going to bow down. I'm an American. I remember thinking that way. I don't bow down. Attitude. I even had the head sway to it. Okay, we don't do that here in America. Well, when you start thinking about it, we are just humbling ourselves to the teachings. We're not bowing down to false gods. Some of this thing, some of these other perspectives might be. We are humbling ourselves before the teachings. And when we do the prostrations, it is actually a very beautiful practice. It's an amazing practice. All right. Every time that we enter the Gompa, you will see people. I did my prostrations before, you know, because I come early. So every time I step into a Gompa, every time I step into the spiritual place, I do that. And it's a humbling of myself to the teachings. And it's a beautiful practice. And when you start to think about it like that, again, everything's a practice. And this is about my mind. My practice is about my mind. Each of you have your own practice, and your mind's going to be slightly different than mine. So if you have more anger issues than impatience, because I'm not angry, I'm just impatient, okay, you figure out your mind, and you learn to work with your mind. These are the tools that will help you to do it, but you figure it out. Okay, so doubt. Let's see, ignorance. Ignorance is just not knowing. You just don't know. But we have the ability to know. So we've got the opportunity to know. So we do that. Anger, we've talked about. Attachment. What is attachment? Anybody have an idea of what attachment is? Because this is going to be a big word, and we have American ideas of what that is. Attachment to things, materialism. What else? Letting go. Oh, fear of letting go. Okay. Traditions?
Yep.
Okay. Yes.
Attachment to people.
Okay. So we're kind of talking about things, that we're, but what does it actually mean? Okay. Love of things. Isn't there somebody in the back?
Fixation on an outcome.
That's a good, I haven't heard that one. Okay. Okay, kind of putting a little bit more on there. Okay. So think about, because we say, we actually even think about attachment being a good thing. I'm very attached to my husband. I'm very attached to my children. I'm very attached to my reputation. You know, so attachment. Attachment is taking and blowing way out of proportion the reality, and putting part of you in there. Okay? I'm trying to think of the perfect words, and I lost them just now. It's overemphasizing, doing a great, what's the word I'm looking for, Chris? That one word.
Exaggerating.
You're exaggerating. You're exaggerating what's going on. You're exaggerating the good qualities of that person. Okay? What's your name? I can't remember.
Bob.
I love Bob. I love Bob. He is the kindest, most wonderful, beautiful person in the world, and he makes me happy. Bob makes me happy. All of a sudden, Bob and I are very happy, and we're going along, and then Bob finds... What's your name?
Carol.
And Bob and Carol. Bob drops me for Carol. No, I don't like Bob anymore. Okay? All of a sudden, boom, that love turns to hate. Okay? So I'm attached to Bob and that love because of what Bob is doing for me. I don't love Bob. The attachment is about me. That love is about me. If I truly love Bob, I'd want Bob to be happy, no matter what, if it's with me or not. But I all of a sudden take Bob and I make him this wonderful, perfect... I don't see the real Bob. I make up all of these stories about Bob. Yes. It's very conditional. Attachment is very conditional. And it's all about your conditions. But you exaggerate these qualities. And you put these things, you put this other story, you put all these other things on top of that. So we're exaggerating. We're exaggerating all these qualities. You know, we overemphasize. And then when it goes the wrong way, we exaggerate the bad, too. So we've taken the reality completely out. Taken the reality of the situation or the reality of Bob completely out of it. So we get attached because we want this particular outcome. Is this making sense? This is not so easy to understand some of these concepts sometime. Richard, anybody want to take a swing at attachment? You can.
Okay, so we're exaggerating these qualities. Okay, we exaggerate. And we can do this easily. I honestly have things that I think are just stunningly beautiful. And I have attachment to them. And somebody else can look at the same thing and think, are you crazy? Because you see things from a different perspective. But I have attachment to this. And so I'll overemphasize things. A lot of the times this does happen in relationships especially. As people get married and they get divorced. You know, if you... Now, let's do a definition of love so that we're talking about the same thing here. Okay, what's a definition of love that we can work with? As we continue this class and we talk about this stuff, what's a definition of love?
Respect.
Respect. Okay, that's a word, but what would love be? Would we agree with this, that you wanting that other person to be happy? That's a nice, clean, simple. I want that other person to be happy. I love that person. That means I want that person to be happy. Okay, so wanting the other person to be happy. Other person or being to be happy. Because we're kind of talking about happiness in this class, right? Oh, we're going to go through a definition of happy here. Okay, I want to do a definition of compassion, too. Because these are things that are going to come up and we're going to talk about in class. The definition of compassion. Could we all agree that the definition of compassion is hoping and wishing that that other being not suffer? That's probably a very good definition we could all agree on. Okay? We don't want that other being to suffer. Okay? We want them to be free from suffering. Okay? Let's do a definition of happy. Because this is going to be interesting. Happy. Define happy. I almost shouldn't allow you to do this one. Okay?
An action associated with that. I mean, you don't want others to suffer, and therefore you can't.
You're cutting ahead. There is. But that's. So, not in compassion, but in bodhicitta. We're going to get there. God's far. But yes. And Tara actually is love in action. So we're going to talk about that. Okay? She is the Buddha of love in action. Okay? So, we've got love, wanting the other person or being to be happy. We're going to talk about this compassion, wanting that other being or person to not suffer. Okay? Now, let's go there. From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, from a Buddhist perspective, we're not only talking about people here. Okay? We're not only talking about people and animals here. We're talking about all sentient beings. That means bugs. See? All right? So that means all sentient beings. That means all living beings. Sentient. Okay, what are we talking about when we're talking about beings? Semchen, mind bearer. Semchen, mind bearer. Anything that has a mind is who we're talking about when we're talking about other beings, that we want everyone to be happy. We want everyone to be free from suffering. We're talking about humans. We're talking about animals. We're talking about microbial beings. Anything that has a mind. We're talking about animals. We're talking about bugs. We're talking about those cockroaches and those mosquitoes and those wood ticks. There's a practice. Okay? But if we're serious, anything that has a mind, we want them not to suffer. Would you agree that every single person in this room, the only thing that we all really want is to be happy? There isn't a single person that says, I don't want to be happy. It kind of levels the playing field. Would you agree that every person in this room would like to be free from suffering? You could probably easily say that everybody on the planet, everybody would just like to be happy and free from suffering. It's not so hard to understand that description when we look at it with these. Their notions of love and compassion, they're trying to do it their way. We may not agree with their way, but that's what they're trying to do. Okay, happy. Where am I? 809. Okay. How far am I? Okay, we're okay. Okay, happy. Definition of happiness. And I'm not going to let any Canopus Center people answer that one yet.
Acceptance.
Okay, happy. Acceptance. Okay. There is a real easy definition. Acceptance. Okay, what else is happy? Appreciation. Okay. Appreciation. Okay. Yeah, that's one of them. It really is. That's really part of it. We tend to, from an American point of view, we tend to mix pleasure and happiness are synonymous to us, and that's really not right. And I do it. I say it. We say it in everyday talk. Oh, you know, that makes me happy. That's pleasurable. That massage makes me happy. It felt good. You know, visiting with my family made me happy. That's pleasure. So if we define things, and we're trying to come at a definition, because if we have a definition, we can work with it, right? Okay, so freedom from suffering. Freedom from suffering. If we were free from suffering, if we were free from all of these things, if we were free from all of these things, all of these negative things, sounds kind of happy to me. Yeah? Does it? Why? Okay. It's okay. Okay. So what's the other side of that then? There you go. So let's go back to... the definition of enlightenment, developing the positive states of mind that leads to happiness, and removing the negative states of mind that those cause suffering, and that's enlightenment. So increasing the positive. We've gotten rid of the negative. Now we increase and develop the positive states of mind, and that's happiness, and that's enlightenment. It does sound so easy, doesn't it? Now, try the red light thing, and you'll see how hard it is. Okay, but that's the practice. Does this make sense? The Buddha is saying that if we do these things, we can be happy. And if you practice and start doing these things, you'll see that it does work. It works for me. Give it a shot. Okay? It's easy to say, and it makes sense. The trick is to do the practice. Okay, so develop the positive, remove the negative. It's that easy. All right, so we've defined the truth. We know what dukkha is, so we know what the suffering is. Okay, the truth of the cause, what's causing that? The truth of the cessation, we want this to stop. Okay, so we want the cessation of suffering. We want suffering to stop. How much time? 13. Do you guys want to do... We still want to do a meditation at the end, right? I'm going to stop here for a second, okay? What questions do you guys have? We're right here. Okay, what questions? I want to make sure that we... Yes, ma'am. Yep. I'm totally forgetting the mic. Okay, now I will open it up. We've got like 6 Canopus Center members that have been studying for a long time, not just me.
So I noticed that the definition of love is conspicuously absent of the idea of self-sacrifice. Is that deliberate? Where does self-sacrifice fall?
Okay.
Positive, negative.
I want you to say that again, carefully and slower.
Okay. So the way you define love is interesting to me because it does not include the idea of self-sacrifice. And I'm wondering, does that fall more onto the positive or the negative state of mind?
My first question is, why is there have to be a sacrifice there? That's my first question. I just want to make sure.
I don't think there does. I just find it interesting because every religious tradition I had ever grown up as a part of, that had been a big element. And I think it's a flawed element, but I just wonder, where does it fall in Buddhism?
All right. I've got a couple of answers, but I want to see if anybody else wants to take a swing at it before I do. There. Let's go here. This is Khandola. Venerable Khando, we say the La.
Let's see how badly I can mess this up. What I would invite you to think about is love wanting other people to be happy.
It is, but it's directional.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. And so wanting other people to be happy to such a degree that we would be willing to delay something that we wanted at the moment for that other person to experience happiness. For example, when, if you have kids, you found a pair of shoes you really liked, and your kid needs shoes for school, but you get your child the shoes for school. But what I would suggest about that is that there's nothing wrong with having the shoes for yourself. That would make me temporarily happy. I like a nice new pair of shoes. Okay. But buying shoes for my child and seeing them go off to school in their new shoes not only makes me happy at that moment, it's a happiness that just doesn't fade. So it kind of has a reality to it, a realness to it, that never goes away. I can't tell you about shoes I bought 10 years ago, but I can tell you still with great joy about a shopping trip with a little kid who wasn't used to having anything. But that meant choosing to not have something for myself. So I know in other religions they talk about self-sacrifice, but what I think enables so many of the practitioners in the great religions to do that is that the giving up for the benefit of others brings them a happiness that... It's a little bit different than the chocolate cake.
Yep. It's a byproduct.
And I don't know if that addresses your question at all.
It does. The one thing I'm going to add to that, because I think that it does, the difference is that the way that you're talking about it is it's a listing of you must do this, you must do this, you must be self-sacrificing, you must do this. Self-sacrificing when is almost a byproduct of what we do because of love. So when you are there, it is not a sacrifice. When you're truly there, just like what she's saying,
I would say it's both and, because we're not enlightened.
Well, true.
I might look longingly at the thing I didn't get temporarily, but chose. And
yep.
Because I'm not enlightened yet. I'm still in samsara, and I still like, you know, the ruby red slippers.
Yep.
I'm supposed to wear them now, too, so what can you
say? I know. There it is. But it is more, because it's there. Self-sacrifice is there in Buddhism, too, with bodhicitta, all of those different things.
There was one other thing. And I think I would, when you were talking about pleasure versus happiness, what I would say is that pleasure is happiness, but it's a temporary very it's like...
impermanent happiness.
It's going to come and it's going to go, and it's going to come, probably go pretty quickly. Whereas the kind of happiness that when you think about others or you think about really taking good care of yourself, you know, being compassionate with yourself, it grows. It never diminishes.
Yeah.
So I'm done.
No, that you're good. That was very good. Like I said, these explanations will be so much better than things that You know, I can...
I'm a total rookie here. But to talk about happiness and self-sacrifice to me would suggest that there's X amount of happiness, and if you give it away to somebody else, then there's not enough left for you.
And that's just exactly what she was saying. I want to make sure that mic's right.
With love, people sometimes think, well, I love this person, so I can't love these people
over
here. And we have that quantifying sensibility.
And it's not. It's endless. It's love is endless. That's exactly what she was doing. It grows and grows. Yeah.
I may be incorrect on this, but I'm also thinking to a certain point that the phrase of self-sacrifice is a little bit of an oxymoron. If you're looking at it as a sacrifice, generally is we look at that as a negative connotation associated with it. But if you're doing something, you know, in that vein, it should not be a negative.
Right.
So to refer to it as you know, sacrifices, like I said, to me almost seems like an oxymoron to a point.
And that's part of where I was trying to go with when you're in that moment, just like what Condola was saying, you know, it's not a sacrifice to do things for the people that we love at all, really. You know, for those of us that are have, you know, parents, spouses, children and stuff, when you do something good for them, you know, we could so easily go by the different things for us. Doesn't mean we can't do that too. Buddhism, we're going to get to that too. Doesn't mean we give up everything. But it just, when you're in that moment, it is, it feels so good to give and to do things for other people. And that may entail some sacrifice on your part. And it probably does. We don't think about it, but we don't think about it that way. We don't think about it as a sacrifice. So, but there are points, I guess, to answer your specific question. There are things in Buddhism that will go down that path, but I think we talk about it differently and we think about it differently. What other questions?
Yeah, I agree with you about the oxymoron. I think self-sacrifice is a matter of intention, because you can sacrifice in a negative way, you know, with negative thoughts, where I think true self-sacrifice, you almost don't think about it. It's just something natural that you're almost driven to do.
And you don't really think about it as a sacrifice at that point.
Yeah, it's just a natural part of life.
Yeah.
You know, like
Kundala.
Yeah. And I think there's a difference between happiness and contentment. You know, happiness is a temporary state, where contentment is a general state of mind. And I think that comes more from being happy with what you have and having ways to deal with those things that you don't like that you have. Nothing wrong with happiness, but it is temporary. And contentment is what I strive for, is to have that equanimity, I guess you could call it.
And that's good. Don't forget joy, though. Don't leave joy. Okay.
Speaking of joy?
Yep.
I find joy in change a lot of times. I think it's just adaptation, sort of evolving with situations. So I'm having trouble with the concept of the suffering of change. That's, I don't get it.
You can feel free.
I'm not sure I can answer it, but I see where you're coming from. For example, being on the beach and watching the waves roll in, that gives me contentment, pleasure, happy, you know what I mean? But just, and it's just constant change. You know, the tide will come in, the tide will go out, you know, and that is impermanence, things changing moment to moment. But if you try to hold, the point of the suffering of change is, if you tried to hold the waves in one spot because you decided that one moment of that wave was the perfect wave and you're not going to be happy looking at anything else but that one moment, then the fact that the wave insisted on keeping changing. So that's what I'm, yes, everything is impermanent. I mean, the minds that walk into this room at, anywhere from 6:45 to 7:05 are not the mind sitting here now.
Yeah.
You know, we've had many, many mental moments that have made us a tiny bit different. And probably for many of us, some of it's been boring, some of it's been enjoyable, some of it's been, maybe I'll come back, maybe I won't, you know. But it's been a lot of change. And so that's, I don't know if that addresses your...
Well, you were right before, it's resisting change that really causes suffering. If you accept change, then...
Yeah, and, if yeah. It, and that the suffering is going to, and the change is going to, it is going to happen. We are going to get old, you know. You know, and you can either try to do it with a little bit of grace or...
Go crazy.
Annoy yourself and others.
We're gonna stop now and do a meditation, much as I love. Next time I'll stop earlier so we can have more discussion, because this is where the real learning will come, okay? As we get more and more away from just the factual stuff that we need to do and get into more of the conceptual stuff we want to talk about. Okay, so the next, we're going to do another meditation, but next class... We will talk more about what it means to be a Buddhist. We'll get into karma. We'll finish this. So we'll get into more discussion type and concept things. You just needed to have a basis of some of the factual information, and now we can get into more of the conceptual. So that's what we're going to do next time. So for now, we're going to go into another meditation. We're going to do a meditation called Counting the Breaths. And again, these are up on the Kadampa Center website under Buddhism in a Nutshell. And this is handout number 3. So the first thing is to get yourself settled in that 7-point meditation posture and think about your legs and your back and your arms and hands. Shoulders, neck, and eyes, and your jaw and your tongue. Just get yourself in that meditation posture and begin to calm your mind by focusing your attention on your breathing. Just breathe naturally and focus your mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present and ready to engage in meditation. And again, we're going to create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session. Think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Start by focusing your attention at the opening of your nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensation as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move, cooler sensation as you inhale, warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Just place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath at the opening of your nostrils. And your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, mentally count each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations. When you reach 10, begin again at 1. If you become distracted, if the mind wanders to other things and moves away from the point of concentration, then begin again at 1. Even if you never get past 2, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only So I'm going to be quiet, and you're going to count from 1 to 10 as you breathe in and out. This concentration, this counting the breaths, can take some practice to attain. And once you start attaining some of that mastery over the technique, then you can try reaching 10 and counting backwards from 10 to 1, and then from 1 to 10. There's several different ways to do this particular meditation. But for now, we're going to dedicate all that positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Okay, thank you so much for coming tonight. If you've got any questions, I do have my email up there, membership@kadampa-center.org. You can go to the website. The handouts are there for these different meditations. The other handouts for the class are there, so feel free to read ahead a little bit if you'd like to. And again, this is, we're going to have, normally this class runs 5 consecutive Tuesdays, but on the 23rd, I believe it is, there's going to be a special puja here. Okay, and a puja is a prayer meeting. So we're going to skip that night, and the last class of Buddhism in a nutshell will be the following week. So make sure you're checking your calendars. Now, you are more than welcome to come to this prayer meeting. I'm not going to be in town, otherwise I'd be here. But this puja is a beautiful prayer gathering. All right? And usually they are done partly in English and partly in Tibetan. It just depends on who's the chant master and how they do it. But it's a beautiful prayer gathering. And one of the stories that I was told to explain a puja is, you know how you've got that whisk broom and you're sweeping the dirt? Well, if you had just had a couple of those whisks and tried to move the dirt, you wouldn't get very far. But if you gather whisks, make a broom, you can really move dirt. And it's just like that with the voices. Many voices raised in the same prayer really makes a difference, and you can feel it. It's a beautiful. The first few times that I came to pujas years ago, I didn't really get it. After a while, I just kept coming because I will try several times before I make a decision. And then after a while, when I started understanding a little bit more, when I started actually hearing what they were saying instead of just trying to kind of keep up, all of a sudden the beauty of it, you know, will come. It's not for everybody, but you're free to come, so you're more than welcome to come to that. Everything at Kadampa Center is done for free. We are an entirely generosity-based organization, And we don't charge any dues or fees for classes or anything. And we hope that if you find something a benefit, that you help us keep the lights on and pay the mortgage for the building and the air conditioning in the summer and the heat in the winter. We have donation boxes both in the back as you leave and also in the front lobby area. We do have the Buddhism in a Nutshell books. They did come in, so any of you that are interested in those books, they're out there, and I can help you at the bookstore register if you'd like. And if you've got any questions, please let me know. And thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you next week. Okay? Thank you.